Sweden and Finland want to join NATO. To get in the door, all standing members must say yes. Turkey has some reservations.
This creates a new power game between President Erdogan and the NATO alliance, and we'll just have to see how it works out.
Also today, in North Korea, leaders have touted a startling COVID statistic, zero cases, a number with ideological symbolism in North Korea.
They are completely pure. They are absolutely perfect.
Can't make that claim anymore. North Korea now admits it's got a COVID problem. And another way to assess British society through the decades? Read the Highway Code. That'll tell you how much priorities have changed.
The latest code has a hierarchy of road users. Pedestrians are at the very top and motorized vehicles are at the very bottom.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us today. For more than 80 days, Ukrainian troops in the southern port city of Mariupol have resisted Russia's military onslaught. Ukrainians have taken great pride in that determination. Today, though, Ukraine ordered its fighters in Mariupol to stop. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the country needs its Ukrainian heroes alive. In other parts of Ukraine, though, the fighting continues. For the latest, we're joined now by Dara Masiko. She's a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation, where her focus is on defense and security in Russia and Eurasia. Dara, let's start with Mariupol. We've been following the drama at the Azovstal steel plant for weeks and the Russian assault on the city. Why is Mariupol so significant in this war?
Well, Russia is attempting to create a land bridge down to link its forces in Crimea, and Mariupol was really the last holdout of any type of force, and eventually it consolidated down to the steel plant.
Does Russia now control the city of Mariupol? I mean, what do we know?
That's my understanding with the ordering of the surrender of the troops at the steel plant. I don't believe that there are currently any Ukrainian forces that can liberate that city at this time.
So what is going to happen to those Ukrainian troops who are being evacuated? I mean, among them are injured and those who are not.
Well, so I watched the news unfold this week and I realized that they evacuated the women and the elderly a few days ago. From what I understand, there's a few hundred fighters, some of them pretty seriously wounded, that were still inside the plant today. It's my understanding that they're a mix of Ukrainian military personnel, as well as potentially some elements of the Azov battalion. They're now in Russian custody, so they are being taken essentially to Russian-controlled areas within Ukraine. There are some rumors that they are being relocated to Russia proper. So there are pretty dark days ahead for those individuals who are now in Russian custody.
And the injured Ukrainian troops as well are in Russian custody?
They are. The Russians are claiming that they're treating them. But they are, again, they will be considered prisoners of war or detainees.
Will officials in Kyiv have any kind of leverage in what's going on there?
Yes, potentially. So there are Russian prisoners of war. There are some type of exchanges that are going on pretty continuously throughout this conflict between prisoners of war, bodies of Russian killed in action that are being exchanged. So there's potentially some opportunity there if there is an agreement to exchange some of these personnel.
Staying in eastern Ukraine, but to the north, is Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city. We're seeing reports that Ukraine is mounting a counteroffensive there against Russian forces. What do we know about what's going on in Kharkiv?
So there are significant engagements going on. It's motivated by a few things. So Russian forces that were essentially needing to repair themselves or get additional personnel added began a sort of an orderly withdrawal. At the same time, you have Ukrainian forces attacking them during that process. So as of right now, you know, Ukraine has had a significant amount of success north of the city. In some cases, they've been able to actually press forward to the border of Russia themselves. But it does appear that Russia has given up on that objective of attempting to surround Kharkiv.
And most of the fighting that's going on right now is in the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. Are you expecting to see more Ukrainian counteroffensives in that area?
So essentially, both sides are trading things back and forth, you know, every few days, every week. There are little mini salients that will occur. The Russians will advance and then they'll meet Ukrainian resistance and they'll have to essentially pull back. And the same holds true for the Ukrainian forces as well. So Ukraine has had some significant successes recently with targeting Russian forces near Izyum. They targeted them with multiple bridge crossings and impacted some very significant Russian units were essentially destroyed in that process. In terms of a large, massive counteroffensive push, I don't know that I really see that happening from either side, frankly. Mm. Right now, you're just seeing these smaller engagements along the front.
And while this fighting is going on in eastern Ukraine, Russia continues to target cities far away from the front. I mean, we saw bombings in the western Ukrainian city of Lviv all the while. It seemed Russia shifted its focus to the east. So why these attacks in the west?
So Russia's trying to do several things at one time. They are launching long-range precision munitions at key facilities across Ukraine. What they're trying to do is really impact Ukraine's ability in the medium and long term to have a viable defense industry. They're trying to go after Ukrainian logistics. They're trying to go after Ukrainian rail transfer points to slow the flow of Western weapons, but it's not really working. The Ukrainians are able to repair many of these facilities, but Russia is really trying to go in accordance with some of their strategy and doctrine. They're trying to attack these very specific locations that are important to Ukraine's defense industrial capacity.
Finally, Dara, how do we know what we know? I mean, there's an information war out there. Russia is pushing its narrative. So is Ukraine and powers in the West. How do you navigate that and feel confident about the facts on the ground?
You are absolutely right. There is an information war on right now, and it is absolutely raging. I feel like as a professional, I am only able to see fragments of what's happening to the Ukrainian military, and it makes it very difficult for me to assess the future of this. I'm seeing more information about Russian forces, but what I'm seeing is selected or curated to make them present themselves in a certain way that is not particularly proficient. I suspect the ground truth is different. There are certain things that the Russians are a little more proficient at. I don't have the sense for really the extent of Ukrainian losses. So it does make it difficult to predict the future with any degree of confidence. So what I have to do is essentially caveat what I know and what I don't know. I feel very confident that the Russian advance is not proceeding as they planned. So they are going to have to settle for something much less than what they initially designed their operation for. I think we could be looking at something like a limited recognition of a few oblasts in the east as part of Russia.
Regions, yeah.
Oh, yes, regions like Luhansk and Donetsk. I don't even think Kharkiv is included in that anymore based on how Russia has withdrawn from that region. But again, an outlying question for me is, what is the state and the health of the Ukrainian military? And are they in a position now or in a future to try to mount any type of counteroffensive? I just don't have that information to predict with any degree of confidence.
Dara Masiko is a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation, where she focuses on defense and security issues in Russia and Eurasia, speaking with us about the latest in Russia's war against Ukraine. Dara, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
North Korea's government is finally coming clean. The country does have a COVID problem. The government in Pyongyang has declared a maximum national emergency, reporting more than 50 COVID-related deaths. On top of that, it says 1.5 million people are suffering from COVID-like symptoms. And one key point in all of this, North Korea's population is totally unvaccinated. So will the regime break with its usual protocol and accept outside help as it openly battles the virus? The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
There aren't many advantages to running one of the most isolated countries on Earth. But North Korea has been able to do something most countries couldn't, sealing its borders tight for more than 2 years straight. This has caused food shortages and more poverty. But did it also prevent a major COVID outbreak, at least until recently?
It did, especially given that the population is not vaccinated yet. So it seems like the measures have been quite successful.
That's Fyodor Tertitsky, North Korea expert at South Korea's Gumen University. North Korea probably has already been through small COVID outbreaks in the past, he says, but they were quickly suppressed. And that allowed Kim Jong-un to claim zero COVID cases, not one.
The number zero has very strong ideological meaning. We are completely pure. We are absolutely perfect.
But those claims of purity are now over. There are just too many cases to hide. North Korean state TV recently showed Kim Jong-un dressing down members of his cabinet, saying they didn't work hard enough. He blames them for the million-plus cases of fever in the country. Doctors can only measure symptoms because they don't have much COVID testing. Yesterday, state TV showed Kim Jong-un touring pharmacies. Until now, he was never seen wearing a mask in public. Now he wears two. The situation does appear to be dire. Not only is the population under heavy U.S. sanctions, North Korea also hasn't been getting much food from neighboring China because borders are closed. And that's made people unusually malnourished, weakening their bodies as infection spreads. Tertitsky notes that the North Korean government could have spent the last 2 years stocking up on vaccines, but it didn't.
I think it was a colossal miscalculation on the behalf of the North Korean government.
North Korea has been offered millions of vaccines, even from enemies. South Korea has a standing offer to send them over the DMZ. The U.S. has said it would supply vaccines via COVAX, which is part of the World Health Organization. Russia has offered, and so has China, some of North Korea's only foreign friends. Each time, Kim Jong-un says, no thanks.
I think it was remarkably stupid of them not to do it earlier, but the thing is, they probably have their own considerations.
South Korean officials say the North has so far demanded only the best mRNA vaccines, such as Pfizer or Moderna. North Korea is often ungracious about receiving aid, says Fyodor Tertitsky. The government annoys donors by demanding all sorts of conditions.
It just infuriates the donors and say, well, guys, you're asking for help. How can you do conditions?
But this outbreak may force North Korean leaders to stop being picky. And here's some cause for hope. If North Korea does acquire vaccines, it can probably deliver them really fast. I asked Tertitsky how a country with such dismal healthcare could possibly face a virus that has wreaked havoc even in rich countries.
Your question implies it's quite bad, but the thing is, like, for such a poor country, it's quite good.
He says healthcare in North Korea is very, very basic, but surprisingly widespread. The vaccination rate for common diseases, such as polio and measles, is similar to that of many Western countries. Now, many are also wondering whether the COVID explosion will tame the regime's provocative streak. A recent mega parade in the capital, Pyongyang, with the army rolling out its latest weapons, including long-range missiles powerful enough to strike the U.S. North Korea has been on a spree lately, testing new weapons and violating UN resolutions left and right. Will they stop to focus on fighting COVID? Maybe not. North Korea officially declared its first COVID case last Thursday and then tested new ballistic missiles just a few hours later. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
From Shanghai, a COVID update. China's largest city has been under strict lockdown now for more than 6 weeks. The experience has been frustrating, to say the least, for many of the city's 26 million residents. For others, it's been dire, with limited access to food. The government now says Shanghai is on track to reopen by June 1st, but acknowledges the possibility of the outbreak rebounding. The daily number of new cases in Shanghai has declined steadily for more than 2 weeks. It recorded 800 new COVID cases on Monday. For a comparison, New York City is one-third the population of Shanghai, and it's now averaging about 4,000 reported new COVID cases each day. A third the size, more than four times as many cases. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. This week, Vice President Kamala Harris traveled to the United Arab Emirates. Several other high-ranking U.S. officials also made the journey to offer condolences after the death of the UAE's top ruler. This marks the highest-level American delegation to visit the Gulf nation since President Joe Biden took office. It's not just about expressing sympathy. As the world's Shirin Jafari reports, the trip is also being seen as a gesture of goodwill to improve a strained relationship.
Emirati officials in their traditional white garments greeted Kamala Harris on the tarmac on Monday. Harris flew to the UAE along with Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and CIA Chief William Burns. This was a high-level U.S. delegation, says Giorgio Cafiero. He is the head of Gulf State Analytics, a geopolitical risk consultancy based in Washington.
Kamala Harris is the vice president of the U.S. Going to the UAE right now is an important part of the White House's efforts to mend fences with the UAE.
Relations have been somewhat soured since President Biden took office, and Cafiero says the tension comes from a whole list of issues.
These include the UAE's neutral stance on the Russian-Ukrainian war, Abu Dhabi's efforts to rehabilitate the Syrian regime, relations between the UAE and China.
And the Emiratis, Cafiero says, are unhappy about the Biden administration's efforts to revive the Iran nuclear deal. The UAE sees Iran as a regional threat. It's worried that a new agreement could boost Iranian influence. The UAE is also dissatisfied with the U.S.'s response to attacks from Yemen earlier this year. Now, Giorgio Cafiero says this U.S. delegation is in the Gulf Sheikhdom to help put relations back on track. One reason, Washington is concerned about the UAE moving closer to Russia and China. The change in tone during the vice president's visit this week could be seen in the smiles and the handshakes. The official statements during the visit were filled with words like friendship, partnership, and cooperation. The UAE is in the midst of a political transition. The president, 73-year-old Sheikh Khalifa bin Zayed Al Nahyan, died last Friday. One day later, a group of leaders representing each of the UAE's seven emirates appointed the new president. Christian Ulrichsen of Rice University describes the process.
It's maybe more akin to an electoral college system, in the sense that the electoral college is the seven individual rulers, who themselves, of course, are hereditary rulers. They're not elected by their peoples. And in theory, they elect a president, but there's only been one candidate. There hasn't been a competitive election.
Sheikh Mohammed was already the de facto president. He took over the country's affairs after Sheikh Khalifa, who was his half-brother, suffered a stroke in 2014. So Ulrichsen says, we have an idea about how Sheikh Mohammed is going to rule.
He will continue to put security first. He will continue to adopt an assertive domestic and regional policies. And he has placed his immediate family members and close political allies in all key positions of economic and energy policy.
In the meantime, the list of who is traveling to the UAE to pay respects and who is not reveals a lot about the country's international alliances. Experts say they'll be watching for potential encounters between the world leaders on the sidelines. So far, Boris Johnson and Prince William of the UK have visited, as well as the French President Emmanuel Macron. Regional rival Iran sent its foreign minister. The Saudi crown prince also flew to the UAE. So did Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, and the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas. No news yet of an official visit by Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
As summer approaches, I'll bet you're looking for a good book, whether you're on the beach, your front stoop, or staying in an air-conditioned room. Check out Britain's bestseller list for some essential reading. This is where you'll find the newest edition of The Official Highway Code. The slim volume has shot to the top of the rankings, once again beating out John le Carré and William Shakespeare. Okay, maybe that's not a surprise. Drivers are required by law to read it. And as the book says, reading it reduces the chances of death. How many books can make that claim? The Official Highway Code, though, offers more than just driving rules. So says Catherine Nixie, a correspondent for The Economist. The most read book in the country provides a unique look into Britain's cultural history.
The Highway Code doesn't just chronicle changing use of the roads. It chronicles a changing country, and it does so in quite some detail. It's been reissued regularly since 1931, and every issue is a different snapshot of Britain. So if you look at the early editions, then the drivers in them all wear cravats and Panama hats, and they've got an imperious air, and they seem to be waving people out of their way. This is a period when cars were topless, driving was glamorous, and roads were largely completely lawless. The other people on the road in the early editions, they include sheep and herds of cattle, and of course, a pack of hounds, which would have been a great concern to the kind of gentlemen who were wearing cravats and Panamas. But absolutely nowhere do you get any sense that there might be any women on the roads or driving cars. All the drivers are, without exception, he.
That would not last long. By the 1930s, there were already 2 million cars on Britain's roads. So there was an urgent need to agree to some rules, says Nixie, especially as thousands of people were dying in accidents every year.
You can see, as people get a bit more used to the car, the highway code starts to change. So as vehicles become more sophisticated, roads get busier and more complex, the highway code has to respond to how the roads are changing. So the 1968 edition records that there's been innovations and developments in the way that seatbelts are used, the speed limits that have been introduced. There was now a 70-mile speed limit. Road markings had changed and developed. And there was another development, which is that women now appeared to be on the roads and driving cars, even often by themselves. And the highway code starts to reflect this. And breathalyzers appear because it was only in the 60s that it became illegal to drive while drunk. Although by the second edition of the code, they've already mentioned that it's probably not a good idea. And it starts to hint at the democratization, not just of driving, but of Britain itself. So if you read the early code, not just are they all wearing cravats and Panama hats, but the language is quite complicated. It's quite senatorial. It's quite patrician in its tone. And in later editions, they rewrite it because, quite simply, it used too many long words. And so you can see this shift in the idea that cars used to be something that gentlemen of a certain class took out for a spin, for fun, to being something that was used by everybody and that everybody needed to be able to cope with.
Catherine Nixie says attitudes towards cars are now changing again. Planners are working on a highway code that will allow for driverless cars and account for things like drivers watching TV while at the wheel.
One of the things you see above all in the new code is that it's chronicling a world that is ceasing to capitulate to the car. In the 20th century, the world gave way before the motor car and turned itself upside down for it. And now you get the sense that the world is starting to push back. Cities are kicking cars out, perhaps entirely like Paris, and they're controlling the cars. So the latest code has a hierarchy of road users. Pedestrians are at the very top and motorized vehicles are at the very bottom.
Two legs good, four wheels, well, let's just say two legs more reliable. And there you have it, a book of essential reading for both drivers and observers of British culture. Catherine Nixie there discussing the newest edition of the official highway code. She appeared on the podcast The Intelligence from our partners at The Economist. And you're listening to The World. Sri Lanka is running out of fuel. Locals are in long lines at gas stations or just looking for a ride.
People are actually stranded on streets, unable to get home from work because there are no taxis. So it's anything like I've ever seen before, honestly.
Meanwhile, three oil tankers sit offshore, but Sri Lanka can't pay for the cargo. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Today, the parliament in Finland voted 188-8 in favor of joining NATO. Yesterday in Sweden, the governing party endorsed a plan to join as well. Now NATO has to approve, but one standing member has thrown a spanner in the works: Turkey. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said he would not view Sweden and Finland's applications favorably, and NATO rules state accession by any new members must have a unanimous vote. With us to talk about this is Soner Choptai. He's a senior fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. What exactly did Erdogan say about Sweden and Finland's possible membership in NATO yesterday?
So Turkish President Erdogan's main objections to NATO's Nordic expansion is that there is this Kurdish group called Kurdistan Workers Party, PKK, designated as a terrorist group by NATO for decades now. And Erdogan is saying that there are PKK networks in Sweden and they have to be shut down before Sweden is allowed to come in. This creates a new power game between President Erdogan and the NATO alliance.
Did Erdogan's statements come as a surprise, wheeling in this militant Kurdish organization and their refugees in Sweden?
Indeed, a surprise, because as far as I know, there were talks behind closed door in Brussels between Turkish diplomats and their NATO counterparts, including Swedes. And Turkey had raised these objections. Turkey's objections are valid. There are indeed PKK networks in Sweden that have to be shut down before the country comes into NATO. I guess this is another sign of Turkish President Erdogan has a transactional view of his country's ties with the West and with Europe. And while this issue could have been ironed out behind closed doors, he wants to up the ante against the Swedes, perhaps, but also kind of signal on many fronts that he'll get out of this what he wants to get. One is, in my view, the economy in Turkey is not doing very well. Elections are scheduled for next year. Some analysts are predicting that Erdogan might want to call early elections because the economy won't hold until then. And given the love and hate relationship between Turkey and Europe, Turkey's citizens love a good fight with Europe. So perhaps pushing against Swedes forcing them to come to terms with Turkey's demands is how Erdogan is going to boost his strongman image globally, from which he benefits so much in terms of domestic politics.
Well, since the 1990s, Sweden in particular has given harbor to many Kurdish refugees. But I'm wondering, is Erdogan genuine in his focus on Kurdish refugees in Sweden? I mean, we know that he does not have terrible relations with Putin. Is he trying to push back on two new NATO members and save face by talking instead about Kurds in Sweden?
Look, Sweden has a large community of Kurdish citizens who have nothing to do with the PKK and lots of refugees. But I think a lot of analysts agree that there are PKK fundraising networks in Sweden. And most recently, a Swedish foreign minister did an online call with a Syrian representative of the same group of PKK. And I think the optics of it just did not look right. The timing of it, just as Sweden wants to come into NATO, it's not what you want to do if you don't want to anger the Turks. Have a publicized meeting on video and put it on Twitter. So perhaps Turkish reaction is also telling the Swedes, if you're going to do these things, please do them behind closed door. Another angle is, in my view, Erdogan is telling Putin, look, I may give the Ukrainians hundreds of drones, but one threatened NATO in veto in NATO is perhaps how I'm also showing to you that I'm able to balance my relationship with you.
So now let's talk about what you think Erdogan might want to extract by standing in the way, right now anyway, of Finland and Sweden joining NATO. Is there something he could get from, say, the U.S. or European nations that might make him look the other way?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So the first thing he wants to get is a commitment from the Swedes that they will crack down on PKK fundraising networks, and that will make Erdogan look strong at home. There's also a U.S. angle to this. Turkey has been trying to purchase F-16 fighter planes from Washington. The sale is blocked in the Senate, although the administration supports it. So I'm also thinking, because President Erdogan has a transactional view of Turkey's ties with the West, that there's another transactional aspect here. Probably President Erdogan is telling President Biden, hey, give me a call. We can talk about Sweden's NATO accession if you promise to move forward my country's request to purchase F-16s through the U.S. Senate.
So do you think this is a final decision then from Turkey, or could it be persuaded to allow Sweden and Finland to join NATO?
I think that Turkey can be persuaded. And actually, although President Erdogan has voiced Turkey may use its veto to block Sweden and Finland from coming in, his spokesperson, Turkey's de facto national security chief, Kulin, has said, look, this is not unsolvable. We can find a solution. And I think that at this stage, because Erdogan is really trying to kind of curry favor with President Biden, it has a lot to do with his desire to have good ties with the United States so that markets look at Turkey as a country to invest in. This is especially important if Erdogan is planning for early elections. And the same goes for Turkey's ties with Europe. Turkey and Europe have a lot of political differences, but Turkey is completely integrated economically with the European Union. So if Erdogan is going to win elections, whether this year or next, he can't win them if Turkey has bad ties with Europe and the United States. Markets need to be convinced that Turkey is going in the right direction. And the sign of that is going to be positive ties between Turkey and EU. So I'm not anticipating or predicting a rupture in Turkish EU-NATO ties. I also think that at the end of the day, Turkey will not implement its veto, but it will play a hard game in Brussels. And the most shocking part of it is that what was supposed to be behind closed door negotiations has been aired out by President Erdogan.
Sona Chaptai is a senior fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, speaking with us from Washington. Sona, thank you very much for explaining this so clearly.
Great pleasure. Thank you for hosting me.
Some of Russia's soldiers in Ukraine, according to reports, have engaged in an especially depraved part of war, sexual violence. One Ukrainian official who's been documenting sexual assaults says they have been deliberate and systematic. Proving that, though, in a court of law will not be easy. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has our story. And a word of caution here, Orla's reporting contains details of violence that may be difficult for some listeners.
Marina Bezchestna is deputy mayor of the town of Ivankiv. It's about 50 miles outside of Ukraine's capital. For more than a month, Russian soldiers occupied the area. A few days after Ukrainian troops regained control, Bezchestna spoke to reporters. She was clearly distraught. Bezchestna says girls in Ivankiv started to cut their hair short to be less attractive to Russian soldiers. Then she tells the story of two sisters. They were girls of 15 and 16, she says. They were just children. They hid in their basement. But along with many women, they were dragged out so soldiers could abuse them, Bezchestna says. Irina Venediktova, Ukraine's prosecutor general, has said she's certain that rape is being used as a weapon of war by Russian soldiers. Trauma psychotherapist Jan Kiselhan, who's based in Germany, agrees.
It's to destroy the destiny and the dignity of people like the Ukrainians.
Kiselhan is now advising psychologists in Ukraine about how to speak to rape survivors. He's treated hundreds of Yazidi women from northern Iraq who were held as sex slaves by ISIS.
One of the methods of the IS was to take the woman as a slave and to rape them. But it's not just a sexual issue. They wanted to destroy the society through the rape. And this came to my mind when I heard about many stories from my colleagues from Ukraine.
But proving that the sexual violence is part of a deliberate strategy by Russian troops will be challenging. Inger Schalsbach has spent years researching sexual assault in conflict zones.
I mean, it's hard in any rape case to gather evidence, but to gather evidence in a war situation is even harder. But it's not impossible.
Schalsbach, who's a professor with the Peace Research Institute in Norway, says it helps that survivors are already speaking out. Vika lives in a village just outside Kyiv. Russian troops occupied that area in early March. This week, Vika spoke to Sky News. Vika said the Russian soldier who took over her home treated her not like a woman or a mother, but like a prostitute. He was around the same age as one of her sons, she said. Vika said she wants other women to speak up too, so those who committed these crimes can be punished someday. Psychotherapist Jan Kiselhan says seeing their attackers being brought to justice could help rape survivors with their recovery.
You know, most of the people who suffered rape, they ask me always the question why human can do this. So if they will be prosecuted, it can be a part of the psychotherapy, that they have again a confidence of justice. Justice will just give them a confidence in humanity.
Russia has denied allegations that its troops are committing acts of sexual violence in Ukraine. UN investigators are now on the ground there gathering evidence. In 2008, the UN passed a resolution stating that rape during conflict is a war crime. Professor Inger Schalsbach says this classification is important for survivors.
I know this from Bosnia, where I remember very vividly interviewing one woman who had been raped by a soldier whom she knew and was from her village. And then some people came from the International Criminal Tribunal and they described what had happened to her as a war crime. And she had never thought of it in those terms. And she said to me, you know, when I heard that, that changed, you know, my experience completely.
The International Criminal Court has opened a formal inquiry into war crimes in Ukraine, but it may be some time yet before any Russian soldiers appear in The Hague. The court is still investigating sex crimes and other atrocities committed by Russian troops in Ukraine in 2014. Karim Khan, the court's chief prosecutor, says he cannot guarantee that those responsible for war crimes in Ukraine today will be brought to justice.
I can't promise anything. I'm a prosecutor. All I can promise is ethics, hard work, integrity, following the evidence and trying to use imaginative and creative ways to ensure that justice is not a phantom.
Psychotherapist Jan Kiselhan tells me that survivors can recover, but it takes time. Kiselhan met Yazidi human rights activist Nadia Murad in a refugee camp in northern Iraq in 2015. She'd been held captive by ISIS for 3 months. In 2018, Murad was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Kiselhan says her story proves that recovery is possible. For the world, I'm Orla Barry.
One huge selling point about cryptocurrency is that it's untraceable, a clever way to hide your transactions from a government's watchful eye. But it turns out this is a widely held myth. All crypto payments are, in fact, recorded on a public ledger called the blockchain. And this week, a U.S. District Court judge in Washington said crypto payments are subject to economic sanctions. A Senate committee echoed that. Here to tell us more about sanction evasion and cryptocurrency is Brian O'Toole. He's a former Treasury official in charge of cracking down on sanctioned dodgers. He joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Brian, explain to us, first of all, the myth of untraceability in cryptocurrency.
You know, there's this idea out there that because Bitcoin offers anonymity on either side of a transaction, that it's completely untraceable. And that's just really not the case. There are all of these groups that follow the public blockchain. They follow transactions, and they've traced things like ransomware payments to Russian ransomware actors. It feels a little old-fashioned, but it's like Plane Watchers, right? Plane Watchers uncovered the CIA's rendition program after 9/11, and there are groups out there that do roughly the same thing with these public blockchains.
Basically, in this case, blockchain is a giant ledger, right?
Essentially, yeah, that's what it is. It shows what transaction is there, and the idea behind it is that it provides a level of security and stability because it cannot be altered.
In his ruling, the judge in Washington borrows from the old Saturday Night Live spoof of the McLaughlin group saying, issue one, virtual currency is untraceable. Wrong. Issue two, sanctions do not apply to virtual currency. Wrong. So what does this opinion mean for law enforcement?
So law enforcement and regulatory enforcement relies on a very broad set of definitions that the Treasury Department has out there for sanctions enforcement. If you are a U.S. person, and person is defined as either an individual, you or me, or a company in the United States, you have to abide by the sanctions laws. Therefore, they're all subject to sanctions implications. Thou shalt not transact with Iran, Cuba, certain Russian banks. And so if they violate those regulations, OFAC can go after them with civil penalties, and the Department of Justice can go after them with criminal penalties.
Well, this seems relevant because, of course, Russia has been hit by all kinds of sanctions, financial especially. Could Russia use cryptocurrency to get around tough sanctions? And does this ruling change things?
I've long said crypto is for narco-traffickers and WMD traffickers.
Weapons of mass destruction traffickers.
Right. Like it's not bailing out the 11th largest economy in the world. You know, it's not that hard to move a few million dollars around in cryptocurrency, but you can't really move billions. And you certainly can't replace the trade Russia's lost, the financing Russia has lost, or recapitalize its banking system using cryptocurrency. The liquidity in that market is not there. It's not what crypto is intended for, or at least intended for at the moment. And it's impossible to replace. So there are some kind of leakages that the Treasury Department and others, I'm sure, will pay a lot of attention to. Things like weapon supply chains for the Russians and things like that, where crypto might actually be useful. But for dodging the kind of broadest set of sanctions on, say, the Central Bank of Russia, it's not possible, right? That's $400+ billion. That's unusable. That money doesn't exist in the crypto market.
So because crypto transactions are recorded on this public ledger forever, the blockchain, does that make it kind of like a file of old transactions that prosecutors and the Treasury can look into to discover crimes that maybe took place years ago? I mean, is there a statute of limitations on what officials can go after?
There are statutes in anti-money laundering legislation, and those are typically 5 years. The Biden administration is actually proposing to extend those as part of its klepto capture program. The public nature of those transactions means that if you can crack one end of the transaction, you can figure out where it all goes, and then you can trace it more easily, right? It's really hard to trace transactions across jurisdictions, right, from the U.S. to the Caymans to Singapore to, you know, Hong Kong, and then on back to, say, Russia or North Korea, right? It's really hard to coordinate law enforcement across all those jurisdictions to get to every one of the banks involved in a transaction that has that kind of a payment routing. If you have a public blockchain where it's all just sitting there and the wallets are publicly available, that's a little bit of an easier task in some ways.
Brian O'Toole, formerly with the Treasury Department enforcing sanctions at the Office of Foreign Assets Control. Brian, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much.
When the war in Ukraine started in February, President Volodymyr Zelensky made a plea for foreign volunteers to support the fight against Russia. Nearly 20,000 people heeded the call, including one woman from Utah. Her name is Glenna. She's a volunteer combat medic in Kharkiv. Our story about her, along with all our coverage of the war in Ukraine, is online at theworld.org. Across the island nation of Sri Lanka today, many people got up at dawn to join long, twisting lines at gas stations. Only a few were able to fill their tanks and jerry cans, one sign that fuel supplies there are critically low. In fact, the country's new prime minister says Sri Lanka has only one day's supply of fuel left. Meanwhile, three oil tankers are waiting to dock in the capital, Colombo. They won't unload their cargo until they've been paid. But Sri Lanka is also struggling to pay its debt, and the fuel crisis is just one of the many calamities bearing down on the country. To find out what it's like on the ground there and what led to this crisis, we reached out to Kalani Kumarasinghe in Colombo. She's an editor with the Daily Mirror. Kalani, tell us first what it looked like at gas stations today in Colombo. What was the scene?
There were scenes of absolute desperation. People have been waiting in queues for days, hours on end. It's not very easy because it's a very humid country to begin with. And people have been there foregoing meals and there has been no fuel. So even today, I just got home from work and people are actually stranded on streets, unable to get home from work because there are no taxis, lesser public and private transport options. So it's anything like I've ever seen before, honestly.
So who's like actually on the road? Are they deserted except for those who have the wealth and connections to fill up their vehicles?
A lot of people are relying on their own vehicles, which include a lot of motorbikes and trishaws and their own little cars. But many of them have been unable to find fuel. And many of these people include people like doctors and people in essential services who have been unable to get to work and get back home. So this is a very real crisis we are living through, extraordinary circumstances, but somehow people are managing with the bare minimum. That's what I'm seeing on the ground.
What about the impact on the availability of food? Is there a connection there?
People are panic buying as well. Whoever is able to has been buying more than they needed to, but mostly supermarket shelves have been empty, and more than anything, prices of the staples are increasing day by day, and that has a very, very bad effect on the nutrition of the people.
I mean, it's all intertwined. Can you help us understand, Kalani, how things got so bad in Sri Lanka? I mean, we know the ruling Rajapaksa family has mismanaged the country for many years, but can all the blame be put on this one family?
This problem has been in the making for 7 decades. That means that we have been living beyond our means for the longest time, and we have been a donor darling of world aid agencies and multilaterals. And maybe more than that, there was severe mismanagement that was directly done by the Rajapaksa regime, despite warnings from oppositions and industry stakeholders and basically everyone. So that is how we landed ourselves here.
So Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa resigned under pressure last week. His younger brother, Gotabaya, though, is still president. How is he holding on to power in this crisis?
Well, he has been reluctant to step down since the beginning of all this. For months, people have taken to the streets, and it appears that he's not even willing to give an audience to these protesters, as opposed to his brother, Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa, who actually offered protesters the opportunity to come and discuss their problems with them. Somehow, he has managed to strike a deal with the Rajapaksa family's longtime opponent, Ranil Wickremesinghe, and many have sort of reluctantly agreed to support Wickremesinghe because Sri Lanka is in such deep trouble and we haven't seen a crisis like this ever. So many have reluctantly agreed to sort of make do with the situation until we can bring down the queues to some level at least. That is one of our main priorities right now.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Kalani, what about the political violence and protests that had gripped a lot of Sri Lanka? Is that still happening?
That is not still happening. Fortunately, it was contained to those 2 days immediately after Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa's resignation. And it has all quietened down because there was a curfew coming in and troops were deployed. Police and military are all over the streets in Colombo and every other part of the country. So with all of that coming in, the violence has stopped. And honestly, we are thankful about that.
So what options does the new Prime Minister Wickremesinghe have, even with the reluctant support he's got?
The options are not that great for Wickremesinghe because parliament proceedings didn't look very promising. There is absolutely no consensus on how to move forward politically. There was still a lot of division that was very apparent in parliament. And honestly, it doesn't really seem like Wickremesinghe has a lot of support going forward.
So I'm really curious how working class people are managing and how they'll manage into the future if a solution isn't come up with.
I myself am struggling to get to work every day. It's difficult to send children to school because there's no fuel. Even school services like buses or vans or whatever they use to transport kids to school, they have stopped working because there's no fuel. More than anything, the skyrocketing prices of essentials has affected everyone. Having said that, Sri Lanka is also a very tolerant country. We are used to hardships. So I suppose this perseverance is in them to sort of see this through.
Well, I wanted to ask you about this because this week is the Buddhist Vesak Festival. It's supposed to be a time of celebration in Sri Lanka with people going out and lighting lanterns and going to parks, eating sweets. Are those festivities even happening?
At this time, streets would be illuminated. There would be a lot of lanterns. There would be a lot of distribution of food happening in the spirit of giving. That is the central idea to this holiday. But times are so bad that people can barely manage their own meals. So they have not been able to do that this year. And that, I don't think, has ever happened in this island nation's history.
Kalane Kumarasinghe is an editor with the Daily Mirror in Colombo. She joined us from Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo. Kalani, thank you again for giving us the latest on this crisis.
Okay, you're welcome.
Oil, coal, gas, fossil fuels, the more the world uses them, the worse climate change gets. And right now, energy is getting even more attention as Russia's war in Ukraine shakes up global energy supplies. We're working on a special edition of The World that's all about energy, and we'd love to know your thoughts and work those into our coverage. What are your biggest concerns and questions about energy, both for your own household and for the world at large? Email us a voice memo, the address myworld@theworld.org. Let us know who you are and what's top of mind for you when you think about the planet's energy future. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org, and be with us for our special coverage later this month. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and thank you for listening.